This episode of the DTFH has been made possible by Squarespace. Head over to squarespace.com/Duncan. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to get 10% off a website or a domain. Hey, what's up, everybody? Happy Halloween. What you're about to listen to, it was an idea I had for like a kind of special Halloween episode. It is definitely not the recording of somebody who represents a group of people that have made contact with a very powerful legion of aliens who are about to appear on our planet. It's just an actor that I got to say what you're about to listen to. So don't worry, I'm not being threatened. I definitely did not make an agreement with a very powerful group of people to put secret messages into this podcast in exchange for wealth and power. It's just a Halloween gag. So this is what I was going to do until I realized by the time anybody listened to this, it wouldn't even be Halloween anyway.
You know we have an agreement, and if you break this agreement, it's going to be very detrimental to your well-being. You know what you're supposed to do with your podcast. You know the message you're supposed to put out there. So, if you decide to break this contract, are you recording this?
Obviously, I did not record a person who represents a group of people that have made contact with a fleet of alien ships that are just outside of Jupiter and are about to make this their home planet. I have most certainly not made a deal with them in which, in exchange for playing a simple tone on my podcast, a sound wave on my podcast, I will receive more wealth than I've ever dreamed of and eternal life, along with a harem of some of the most beautiful, not just women, but beings from all across the galaxy. Nope. This is just a Halloween gag, meaning the following tone that you're about to hear is nothing you should worry about, and in fact is something you should enjoy with headphones in a room with ultraviolet light, preferably, and you should listen to it at least 3 times in a row to ensure that the sonic seeds or the eggs of the Great Mother are planted in the nest of your wretched human mind. Again, I'm not selling out my species, just a fun Halloween gag. So let's listen to this innocent tone that is definitely not a mind control sound wave that will force you to be obedient to the great ones when at last they come. Are you happy now? I've definitely not sold my species out to aliens, but even if I had, I would still be excited about today's guest. Mitch Horowitz is with us today. We're going to jump right into it, but first, some quick business. I can remember one of my friends telling me the terrible story of feeling his teeth get punched out by an upset pseudo-web designer who had become frustrated with his notes and crawled into his window wearing a pair of brass knuckles and carrying a iron pentagram. He smashed his teeth in with the brass knuckles, and then he heated up that iron pentagram and left a horrible eternal burn on my friend's neck. This used to happen all the time because pseudo web designers who barely understood how to make websites would get all jacked up on meth or amphetamines, and then you would complain about the horrific website that they made for you, and they would come and just break your legs, beat you, abuse you, burn you, or even climb into family cemeteries and dig up the coffins and crypts of your family members and desecrate their bodies. We no longer have to go through this thanks to Squarespace.com, because Squarespace has everything you need to make a beautiful website. They have award-winning templates that you can choose from to create any kind of website you desire. They have everything you need, from a shopping cart function to the ability to size to any device. You no longer have to worry about having to rewrite HTML, or even worse, ask some moon-boggled lunatic to make it so that your website fits to every device, a request that would surely end with you waking up in the middle of the night with chopsticks being hammered into your nipples by a lunatic. We're safe now. We have Squarespace to save us from these horrible moments. I still have scars on my nipples from those days. Squarespace. You don't need it just because you want to build a business, by the way. It's the ultimate tool if you just want to make an announcement, if you want to promote your band, if your wedding's coming up, or maybe you just want to make a website that you could send to your dad that makes him think someone has built a website accusing him of being in cahoots with ISIS. I'm not recommending that you do that, but you certainly could do that by going to squarespace.com/Duncan. Use offer code Duncan when you're ready to launch, and you will get 10% off your first order of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/Duncan. Use offer code Duncan, and you'll get 10% off a website or a domain. The proof is in the pudding, friends. If you want to see a Squarespace website, head over to DuncanTrussell.com. I use Squarespace to upload episodes of this podcast, and I absolutely love the service. Thank you so much, Squarespace, for supporting this episode. If you find yourself waking up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, wondering how you could best support the DTFH, there are many ways, from the most simple to the most complex. The most complex would be to go to the volcano of Ulanak and dig up the golden sphere that an enemy necromancer buried there 5,000 years ago. The most simple would be to subscribe and to leave a nice comment or a rating on iTunes. It actually helps a lot. Another great way would be to support the lunatics who allowed me to promote their products on this podcast. And another way to do it would be to subscribe over at patreon.com/DTFH. This will give you access to episodes of the DTFH that are commercial free. There is also an extra hour-long rambling, ranting thing a month at least, as well as other odd stuff that pops up there, including access to our Discord server. So head over to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe. We also have a great shop with all new stuff, which you can find over at DuncanTrussell.com. And finally, if you're in LA on Friday, November the 16th, I'm going to be doing a kind of podcast thing, I don't know what you call it, with my meditation teacher, David Nickturn. That's going to be at the Samarasa Center from 7 to 9 o'clock. And it's a conversation that we have about meditation and Buddhism. I've really enjoyed these chats, and I hope you will head out and say hello. That's Friday, November the 16th at the Samarasa Center in Echo Park. All right, let's do this podcast. Sweet friends, today's guest is a occult scholar, an expert in metaphysics, an author, and a wonderful speaker who has just published a fantastic book on the topic of New Thought, which you might be familiar with if you've seen The Secret, or if you've read Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, or Ernest Holmes' The Science of Mind, or if you live in LA and go to Agape Church. It's the concept that our thoughts create reality, and different methods that can be used based on that concept to bring us closer to our goals and to bring things into our lives that we desire. It's a fantastic and controversial philosophy, and our guest today does a brilliant job, not only in explaining this idea, but also in addressing some of the more difficult, paradoxical parts of the idea that some other authors seem afraid to even mention. You can find out more about Mitch by going to mitchhorowitz.com. I'll have all the links at duncantrussell.com. But now, everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, Mitch Horowitz. Mitch, welcome to the DTFH. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I am a big fan of yours, I admire your ability not just to write, but also your ability to convey some of these very dense ideas in an informative and entertaining way that I think so important to be able to be a bridge like that. And so I was thwarted in an interesting way, knowing you were coming here, in the sense that there's a million different things that we could talk about. But I thought you have this wonderful book, The Miracle Club, that's out right now, which covers a thing that I have been deeply interested in and have used with some success, and also have a little bit of, for lack of a better word, apprehension about it to some degree. Is that the right word? Not apprehension. Yeah, apprehension.
Yes.
And so that's what I'd love to talk about. And I really want to take advantage of the time that we have so that my listeners can maybe get a little seminar in converting thought patterns into reality, which I think is a possibility, but maybe isn't quite as easy as it sounds. So I just want to start off with a question I saw you ask yourself in one of your many great talks online. Is the purpose of the spiritual search, thy will be done, or my will be done?
That's the central question. That's the central question. I want to be very plain about answering that rather than eluding it or trying to dilute or change the question. For me, at age 52, the central purpose is my will be done. Mm. That's the path I walk. I believe that desire is sacred. I believe that we are here for a limited period of time to be generative and to be productive. And I realize all the baggage that my response comes with. I realize people are going to hear that and say, well, which I, and which I are you thinking from? Which I are you manifesting from? Or is there a difference between the higher will and the lower will? I honor and I bow before all those questions, but I've been walking this path for a long time, and I'm not going to be here for an infinite amount of time. Mm. When you're looking at life from middle age and from children who have entered adolescence, it tends to render your focus sharper and more serious. Mm. And I believe that the individual will and individual desire is sacred. And I don't make a distinction between higher and lower. And frankly, at this point in my path, I don't even make a distinction among multiple eyes. I don't speak in terms of ego, inner, outer, personality, essence. I think there's one of you and me, and we're here for a finite period of time. Many things have claims on us, but attainment has a primary claim, I believe. And I believe in the statement, my will be done.
Cool. That's great. Okay, great. You just made me scratch off all the other questions I have.
We can just hang out and, you know, enjoy the weather. Yeah. Why not?
But, you know, I did one thing that, before this question, forgive me. I'm going to quote Bob Marley.
All right.
A hungry man is an angry man.
Yeah.
And, I think that, you know, it's all good and well to get to this point of like, thy will be done through me. Therefore, I'm not going to sort of try, or I'm not going to push forward something into the world that's going to like give me material comfort.
Yes.
But when you're hungry, or you have a kid that needs food, or there's like an actual deep, deep, real primordial need there.
Yes.
I don't know. The thy will be done thing, I think, becomes a little... it seems like a great idea.
Yes.
Until you need a glass of water and there's no water around. And,
yes.
You know, some survival issues. So that being said, I was watching a Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche talk.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something that stuck with me, which is, before you can reject yourself, mm-hmm. you need to know yourself.
Yes.
Similarly, even though you did say, look, it's all sacred, I do feel like, isn't there a sort of step-by-step process here before you start getting into mind manifestation? Won't it save you some trouble to actually know who you are so you can really know what you want? Guys, if you ever wondered what it would feel like to have a wizard's cock, then you'll be very happy about today's sponsor. It's BlueChew.com. BlueChew.com. This is the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. So you know they work. But not only that, I can tell you that they work because I don't promote anything on this podcast that I haven't tried. And I was very excited to try these wonderful Blue Chew chewables. That's Blue Chew, as in blue, the color blue, like a bluebird with a giant throbbing iron cock. BlueChew.com. They're prescribed online and shipped straight to your door in a discreet package. So no in-person doctor visit, no waiting in the pharmacy, and best of all, no more awkwardness. Outside of the awkwardness you might feel when you realize your penis could be used to punch holes in a bank safe. Imagine what would happen if the Statue of Liberty got an erection. BlueChew.com. Right now, if you go to BlueChew.com and use our special promo code Duncan, you will get your first shipment free. You just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code Duncan, to try it for free. Blue Chew is the better, cheaper, faster choice, and I am grateful to them not only for sponsoring the podcast, but for sending me a pile of chewable boner pills. What else could you wish for? These sweet, wonderful, magical chewables are made in the USA, and since Blue Chew prepares and ships direct, they're cheaper than a pharmacy. Thank you, Blue Chew.
That's a wonderful question. My wish is that getting in touch with one's authentic desires becomes a form of self-scrutiny, a path to self-scrutiny, because there are going to be failures. There are going to be dead ends. There are especially going to be failures of perspective. We've all had the experience where we wanted something. Maybe we lusted after another person, or maybe there was a particular job offer that we wanted to get. And I've certainly had experiences where I could be very persuasive with myself and others about something I wanted to attain, maybe something in my career. And I've had the experience, as I'm sure your listeners have had, of not getting it and saying, thank God I didn't get that.
Right.
That would have been the worst thing. And that calls into question about this whole nature of who am I? What is my perspective? Am I able to see more than a couple of feet forward on the road? My contention is this. I think that over the course of life, there are inevitably times where we're going to make terrible mistakes. We're going to demonstrate a lack of perspective. We're going to be thinking from a place of very short-term gratification, and we may get hurt. But I really do believe in my heart that there are instances in life where every sensitive person does have moments of exquisite clarity and exquisite perspective. And I was just speaking with someone about this. There are some people you meet who know exactly what they want out of life at age 6. And however they get buffeted around by the currents of life, they still know it. They still know it. And they feel intrinsically when they're separate from it, when they're gravitating more closely to it. I would say, in truth, we all have that primordial understanding of what we really want. We may circle around it. We may hit dead ends. We may bump into walls. But I don't think that life has played this cruel joke on us in which we're fully bereft of perspective. We're sometimes bereft of it, and we're sometimes misled, and we will get hurt. But there are many, many times, I think, moments of sensitivity, moments of exquisite instinct, where we do feel what we want. And I counsel people, follow that. That's precious, precious information that we're being granted.
Cool. Because it's like, yeah, you get these like desires, and then it's sort of like the Buddhist concept of the poison arrow. So here is some desire, whatever it may be. And then the desire gets almost instantly followed with a myriad of judgments or potential repercussions.
Yes.
Or this is an indication of you slipping into a bad place, or all of these things follow this initial desire. And it seems like what you're saying is that initial desire has within it some kind of truth, some kind of...
I really believe it does. And it's funny, you know, we repeat things to ourselves like, well, money doesn't make you happy, or career success doesn't make you happy. And I would take a second look at those truisms. I would take a second look at those truisms because, for example, let's say you can identify a famous actor who behaves obnoxiously, and there are any number of examples that you could select from.
Right.
You could look at that person and say, well, see, he's a case in point.
Yeah.
The pinnacle of success hasn't made him happy. He misbehaves. And I would say, well, let's take a second look at this. It may be true that that person misbehaves, and that is a problem. It's also a problem for those around that person, and they have things to answer for themselves because they're remaining in his orbit because he gives them goodies. But the fact is, if that person didn't become the performer that he or she is, I believe they would probably have a yawning gap in their lives, and they would probably feel a sense of being lost and stuck in a kind of vacuum and not knowing what to do. I think our desires can point towards something very vital and significant. You know, I was watching recently this two-part documentary about Elvis Presley on HBO, and Bruce Springsteen was narrating part of it. And Bruce said that later in his life, when Elvis was up on stage in his sequin jumpsuit and everything, that actually was the real guy. That's who he was. And it was only when he got home at night and tried to function as a private individual that he had difficulties.
Wow.
And I thought that was a good observation. And it was probably an observation basically that Bruce was making about himself and putting on somebody else, which is what we often do. But I thought it was valid. But I also thought to myself, and so what? And so what? I think he's correct. That was the guy on stage. He was funny. He was relaxed. His fans loved him. He loved them. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? He was providing for people.
Right.
I'm not aware that he ever did anything that deprived anybody of anything around him to which they were entitled.
Yeah.
So what's wrong if Elvis was only real when he was on stage? I think we have to be flexible about these things, and we have to ask ourselves, maybe that's exactly where he belonged and exactly what he should be doing. So he never got the garage door fixed. All right, get somebody else to get the garage door fixed.
Right.
It has to be fixed, and we have to take care of that, but that's not his job.
Right.
His job is to do that. What's your job? You know, that's what I would put back onto the listener.
Yeah, okay. So this is great. And again, like, it's just, you know, every so many grimoires or so many books on magic, they start off with this like inevitable warning. Beware your mind, you'll lose your, even the Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism by Chogyam Trungpa starts with, don't go down this path if you can avoid it, because it's a, once you start going down, you got to go all the way. Once you jump in the river, all the way. So
yeah.
Okay. Warnings aside, now listeners have some desire.
Yeah.
So whatever it may be. No matter how mundane or greedy or freakish or whatever, let's just say some folks have these desires.
Right.
And they want to bring this into their reality, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And your book presents a kind of methodology.
Yeah.
That has been refined and developed by many people.
Yes.
Over time.
Yes.
And so I would just love to start getting into that methodology, from the moment of knowing something that you want to the process that a person might go through to see some version of that appear in their own life in a real way.
Yes. The inception point starts with a clarified, passionate desire, as we've been talking about. And that's easier. That's not as easy as it sounds, and it's not as plainly available to us as it sounds, because we mislead ourselves and we tell us ourselves things by rote. You know, I'd like to have lots of kids, or I'd like to travel, or I'd like to climb the corporate ladder, or what have you. Beware of mental habits, because we can get into this recitation of things that we feel will make us look good in the eyes of others, or make us look good in our own eyes in some way. It's exquisitely important to have a clarified desire, not just a desire, but I'm even going to go so far as to say an obsessive aim, a central wish that you have for your life to the exclusion of everything else. Because I think that kind of concentrated psychical energy is extraordinarily impactful and important. And if you scrutinize the lives of people you admire, whether it be Bob Dylan or Nelson Mandela or Helen Keller or Steve Jobs or whomever it may happen to be, you will almost always find that that person was motivated by one obsessional desire.
Right.
And it was all-consuming. And it can be very threatening in a certain way, because I think it's a tough bargain that life strikes with us. We're not given everything. And I actually personally believe that well-roundedness is overrated. You know, Bob Marley was not sitting around worrying about his tennis game or worrying about whether the dishwasher was fixed. He was being Bob Marley. He had this vision of himself as this musical prophet, which he was. Helen Keller was dedicated to uplifting the idea of human possibility and human potential.
Sure.
I don't know whether she was a nice person to spend Christmas with or not. I have no idea. That was the central facet of her life.
Yeah.
You have to arrive at that. And that's a very tough bargain to strike with life. But it can also be a very gratifying bargain. The next thing is, you need to come up with a really concrete, integrated plan of both mental visualization, affirmation, creativity, and outer action, and knowing just when to strike. And you will know when you're exquisitely focused. Relationships and tasks that are superfluous tend to fall away. And I don't mean to sound ruthless about this. I'm just trying to be honest with the listener. When you become focused, you find that you develop much less taste and patience for things that are frivolous. That can include small talk. That can include movies or television shows that really, truly are not worthwhile.
Yes.
And that don't build your aim and your outlook and your point of view. Books that don't build your aim and your outlook and your point of view. And I think you need to be very concrete with yourself about writing down and committing to paper what your goals are, dates, numbers, periods of time by which you want to reach things. Mm. I think I'm not really talking about a go-with-the-flow approach. And the reason I prescribe this, and the reason I think it's so important to write things down and to be specific in terms of numbers and dates, is because these things not only serve to focus and harness one's mental energies, and it's my contention that we do have mental energies that go beyond the cognitive and motor functions and such, but the very act of writing something down from its point of inception is almost the bringing of a tactile, physical actualization of what you're after into the world. And I would challenge the listener, try it. Right now in my pocket, I am carrying with me a card on which I've written a particular goal, a particular sum of money, and the date by which I want to reach
it.
And I have laminated this card with packing tape because I carry it with me everywhere and I want it to be very, very sturdy. There is a certain special something that comes from my carrying that card around because it's a tactile representation of my aim into the world. And it's very no holds barred. It's realistic, but it's very, very bold. And my contention to you would be that if you do this as a mature adult, not flitting from one flower to another like a bumblebee, but you really know what you want and you're prepared to employ affirmation, visualization, prayer, chanting, meditation, every mental faculty at your disposal, including physical modalities, and you're willing to act in outer life in all kinds of ways that are constructive and that are appropriate to the furthering and the pursuit of your goal, and you do this with a concentrated, obsessive passion, you're going to get where you want to go.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to get where you want to go. Try it.
Well, here's what I want to talk about. A person finds themselves either the person just dies or they find themselves suddenly surrounded as a person begins to wake up.
Yeah.
So a person suddenly finds themselves surrounded by this mass of chaotic matter that they stumbled into throughout their lives.
Yeah.
They've been kind of like sleepwalking or whatever. Yeah. And they thought they wanted this or they thought they wanted that. But quite often they end up in sort of what they think of as a rut, or they don't have enough money to pay rent. They can't, their car's about to get repossessed. They are alcoholics. Their life is like in a kind of like a very, very darkened state. And within that darkened state, it's not just that around them is chaos. Within their mind is some form of chaos. And their will is very weak because they are sort of they've created a feedback loop where there's a constant reflection of all their past decisions in the form of everything around them.
Yeah.
And it's affirming I don't want to say impotence because it sounds so severe, but it's kind of confirming this state.
Yeah.
And so I bring that up only because people in that state of consciousness, though they might want to have single pointed focus, even getting that is almost as difficult as a person whose legs have atrophied and who wants to stand up.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Their will has atrophied.
Right.
And so now they do have the desire.
Right.
But it's the desire is even foggy. So how does a person in that state begin to sharpen the will to get to this point of a kind of single pointed fixation?
Yeah, that's a wonderful, wonderful question. And I would respond to that in a couple of ways. First, one of the things that I try to be very clear about in the book and that I refer to many times is that we do live under many laws and forces. I don't believe that within the cosmic framework that we have to function in within this life, not everything is controlled by this one mental super law, which is why I don't use terms like manifest or law of attraction or things like that. It may be, and this is part of a broader discussion, that awareness or intellect or consciousness is the ultimate arbiter of experience. And I do believe that's true, but I also believe that we live in a world in which we experience multiple laws and forces. The law of gravity, for example, is ever operative, but you'll experience it differently on the moon than on the planet Earth because gravity responds to mass. Our lives are a lot like that. So it's not that thought is the only game in town. Obviously, we live under physical limitations. Our bodies eventually decline. There's mortality. There's never been an exception to that. So there are things facing the individual, and there are emergencies facing the individual that I do not contend are the result of mind or thought. It's very, very important to understand that. And I think when the individual is in a desperate situation and he or she just doesn't know what's coming next, the repossession man may be outside the door and so on, there's a couple of things I would say. First of all, I believe very strongly in the power of prayer. And I don't believe life plays a cruel joke on us in which it sends some guy to tell you, hey, you got to focus your thoughts. But when you're in emotional agony, you can't focus your thoughts. I can't focus my thoughts all the time. I happen to be in a very good mood right now, and I'm psyched to be here with you.
Thank you.
But I would be misrepresenting myself to the listener if I didn't say there are also times and nights where I'm in agony, or I'm guilty of committing an act of road rage, or I behave like a real asshole towards somebody, and I don't mean to.
Right.
But the Mitch that you're hearing right now is the best that I am. Thursday afternoon at 2:00, I might be in a really shitty mood and be an asshole, you know, in Starbucks.
Sure.
And I might also be feeling, you know, very sad over something and not able to focus my thoughts. I do believe that prayer is a real and a powerful thing.
Cool.
I do believe in the existence of higher and extra physical forces outside us to whom we can appeal. And I do believe that there are no rules involved in prayer. I've never liked the new thought orthodoxy that you have to pray in this state of calm expectancy and satisfaction as though you've already received what you're after.
Right.
And according to your faith, so shall it be. I know there's precedent for that in scripture, but there's also precedent in scripture for people arguing with God, for getting pissed off with God, for begging, for being angry, for asking God to change his or her mind about things. Like when Cain is punished for this act of fratricide, he says to God, the punishment you've given me is too great. I can't take it. And God says, okay, I'll amend it. I'll put this mark on you where nobody will be able to hurt you. And, you know, there are many instances in scripture of the creator changing his or her mind after somebody argues with him or confronts him.
Right.
There are no rules with regard to prayer.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's
right there. You know, it's right there. You know, people get pissed off and they're like, I can't put up with this. And he's like, okay, I'll work with you here. And so I do think that prayer is ever and always available. And I do think extraordinary things can happen from it. I would also say that if you're in desperate need, don't condition your solution to such an extent that you narrow the path to which it can reach you. Magic or answered prayers or options or possibilities may reach you in all kinds of different ways. Accept them. Accept them when they come into your life. If somebody offers you something, you accept it. You don't say, no, I think there might be something better over there. So it may be that you pray for relief from something, and relief may come in an unusual, unexpected way. It may even come in a way that brings with it other problems and complexities, but it's there. It's what's being presented to you. So when you're kind of going along the path, don't condition your ideas too heavily of what your response might look like. It might come to you in different ways. The path of prayer is open to you. It would be a cruel joke if channeling one's thoughts in positive directions were the only way to kind of get out of a problem, because there are times, honestly, when we're facing emergencies or anguish where that it can't be done. It
right.
can't be done. And there are sufferings in life. New Thought's failure is that it's never come up with a theology of suffering. It has never found a way to meet people who are suffering. That's one of the things I make an effort to work on or to correct in the Miracle Club, because I do think that people who are suffering or who might have a disease from which, frankly, there is no real prospect of recovery, although there are miracles and there are anomalies, and I talk about that in the book, but there are things that play out also according to convention. And New Thought has to be able to meet those people as well. If you're forced to consume half a loaf of bread rather than a whole loaf, and you have to, can that half a loaf be consumed while standing fully erect? And if so, other things may happen. Other things may happen that open up possibilities that are unexpected. New Thought has to be able to address that person.
Yeah, with New Thought, you can run into some like really problematic you can run into some problems with the math, which one specific problem that I wanted to bring up to you is I was at a New Thought church once that I love, and it's authentically like changed, like helped. This stuff is like not in a kind of like sweet way helped me.
Yeah,
has had a real, I've used it and it works. Mm-hmm. But I can remember sitting in this church and there was a sweepstake. For a car, someone, you know, there's a, you know, it's raising money for the church, and mm-hmm. someone was going to win this car.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there thinking like, wait a minute, are we now in a visualization contest?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Is it
yes.
the person who like has in the best used whatever this skill is or science or however it's science of mine, they've yeah. won and everybody else is a little weaker than them?
Right. Right.
Or is it a multiverse situation where you win the thing, you split into another multiverse where everyone else is lost?
Could be.
Or so yeah. But you know what I'm saying?
I do.
Everyone on the planet suddenly begins to adhere to this sort of idea that I can focus my will and manifest and or whatever word you want. I don't want to get mixed up.
Select. Is what I use. Select.
Okay. I could select some reality.
Yeah.
But in a planet where there appears to be limited resources.
Yes.
Like problems with like countries that you can't come into certain countries.
And that's exactly right.
So how does this, to me, that seems to be one of the big logical problems with
yes.
this. How do you work that out?
That's a great question. And, you know, I would refer back to what I was saying a little while ago, which is that we do live under a complex of laws and forces. And I've always rejected the New Age principle that there are no accidents. I think there are accidents. I think things that happen to people sometimes are matters of geography, economics, politics, things that are weather patterns, things that are completely out of the hand of the individual. So when the nation of the Philippines is struck by a horrible monsoon, I completely and roundedly reject the notion that some of my friends in New Thought might hold, which is that, well, you know, the vibrational frequency of people's thoughts mm. was operating on the level of that disaster. There is absolutely no way to verify that.
Yeah.
And in fact, I don't even want to hear from people in such situations who haven't passed through natural disasters, who haven't lived through war, who haven't lived through poverty. This is one of the reasons why I ultimately break with the way of thought of Rhonda Byrne, the writer and filmmaker behind The Secret. I think Rhonda has a lot of good insights into human nature, and there's a lot of very good things I can say about Rhonda. But she was being interviewed several years ago by a reporter from the Associated Press named Tara Burghardt, and Rhonda famously doesn't give interviews, and Tara just emailed her, and Rhonda responded to all these really hardcore questions, and my hat was really off to Tara. And she asked her the $64,000 question, which is, plainly put, what do you say about people who perished in horrible events like the Holocaust or 9/11? Are you saying that their thoughts created that? And Rhonda responded by saying, well, first of all, there were also miraculous exceptions to those events. Okay. And secondly, I do think that it is possible, this is Rhonda speaking, that a population of people can be thinking along the lines of a certain vibrational frequency that vibrate to or have an affinity or correlation with certain events. I not only do I disagree with that, but I think that if you speak about events that you haven't passed through or experienced yourself, such as a horrible catastrophe of war or environmental devastation or a tidal wave or an earthquake, it's nothing other than throwing a stone. I'm just speaking about and explaining away my neighbor's circumstance. I want to hear from the person who went through that, him or herself, if they're still around, to record that to me. I want to hear the testimony of people who have been through this. Tell me about what you've been through. Tell me about what you've experienced. Not what somebody has experienced from another country or another time and place that you've never gone through. I believe there are accidents. I believe that the law of mentation, if there is such a thing, is one vital part of our lives, one part that begs experimentation, along with many other things, including weather patterns and hostilities and political conflicts that the individual, him or herself, bears no responsibility for. I would also say this, particularly with respect to lotteries and gambling and cars. There are people who come to me sometimes and they want help at the poker table or something like that. And I'll do my best to help them because I do believe that the mind can play a role in these things. And I'll meet them where they are, and I'll say, well, let's try this together. Just do me a favor. If you win, and I hope you do, give away 10% of whatever you won to someplace worthy. You know, that's the deal. So let's see what happens. Let's try it together. But more often I find that uncanny results and correlations occur in people's lives over an extended period of time. There's sometimes an interval or a gestation period. A human life requires 9 months of gestation. A horse requires 11 months of gestation. There are gestation periods for everything in nature. So there must be, apropos of our minds as well. So I ask people to watch very, very carefully what unfolds over a long period of time, because we're very forgetful. We can be holding some thought and there's an interval and we forget all about it.
That's
sometimes these things occur over very broad periods of time, not in connection with the sweepstakes or such.
That's great. And that's such an important thing to realize, because it's this for, personally, I always want results way faster than they're ever going to come.
Me too.
Me too.
In a big way.
And, and so then there is this sort of period in between whatever the thing may be, planting the seed, saying the prayer, preparing the focus.
Yeah.
And then some amount of time passes. And within that amount of time, you might even see a reversal, some backsliding or something. And you're like, this
bullshit.
Shit doesn't
work. Fuck Horowitz, right?
Fuck Horowitz. But yet, if you allow that, sort of transitory phenomena to confuse you, then you can again start mentating, I guess you would say, certain patterns that are going to affirm that temporary thing, and then you end up going backwards. The backwards happens because of, let's say, whatever, nature, just some unpredictable, chaotic thing.
Yeah.
But then you attach to that a story, and the story is fuck Horowitz or some version of it.
Right.
This shit don't work.
Right.
Bunch of yap from the witches.
Exactly. Right.
Right. And now you're producing this, the sort of the opposite of what you recommended, which is single pointed focus on a specific thing.
Yes.
And how many mythological stories of realization are just prior to the realization of this being or that?
That's right. That's right.
Always met with the opposite of what they wanted to have happen.
Yes.
Always met by some test.
Yes. And that was true of Moses, for example. If one makes a mythical reading of the life of Moses, he, you know, had all these weird ups and downs occur. He spoke with a speech impediment. He didn't want to be selected as the leader of the Hebrews. He committed a murder in anger. He never was able actually to get his arms around his anger problem. He was ultimately right. punished by God at the end of his life, yeah. not being permitted to enter the promised land because he was pissed off all the time. I mean, obviously, I'm making a mythical reading of the life of Moses, but it was very Byzantine and serpentine and all kinds of things happened. But ultimately, he did do what his aim was, which was he led the Hebrews out of Egypt.
Yeah.
And it was very, very tough. And they spent a generation in the wilderness and all kinds of things occurred. But he did do that. And it was very serpentine. You know, Goethe, it's funny, there's this popular expression, careful what you wish for, you just might get it.
Yes.
And I do the forensics on that in the book. And the closest I've been able to come is, I think, that popular expression originated with Goethe, who put it differently. What he wrote was, what you wish for when you are young will come upon you in waves when you are old.
Whoa.
So be careful. And a lot of people would want to argue with that and say, that doesn't make any sense to me. The ideals and the wishes I had when I was young haven't come upon me in waves. I'm very dissatisfied. Goethe's contention was, we are extremely forgetful. And if you take a yellow light and just don't judge what he's saying immediately, but actually really go back across the layers of your life and ask, is Goethe correct? Have I gotten in waves what I wished for when I was young? Was I not careful? That's where that popular expression comes from.
How cool. That is so simultaneously terrifying and cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy shit, man. Oh my God. Wow. That's cool. Whoa. Okay. So, and you know, I think that, like, so here are these waves crashing into our lives.
Yeah.
And who knows? It depends on, like, what lens you want to look through. Let's imagine, like, I'm reading this wonderful book on karma right now. And, you know, it's sort of breaking down the Vedic conception of karma, which has a lot of really, really cool, like, breakdown, you know, the different sorts of karma.
Yeah.
That there's like four types. One is the karma which has within it every single thing you've done thus far, including in all your past lives. And this is sort of somehow intertwined in your energy body.
Mm-hmm.
And so this thing flowers into your life, just like what Goethe might say.
Yeah,
waves
yeah.
of this thing coming
waves.
To you.
Waves, yeah.
And so now you have all these waves that are crashing in, and you're looking at them and you're like, what the fuck? This is not what I want now.
Yes.
And so now you have to deal with it.
Yes.
And there's no way around it. You just have to pay your tab, you know?
Right.
You got to pay the bill. There's
right.
no way out of that paying
right.
the bill.
Right.
So I just want to talk a little bit about how to simultaneously pay the bill, so to speak.
Yes.
While working on from this sort of like tsunami of past karma.
Yes.
When you were unconscious, though I don't want to say you were unconscious as a teen, but you know,
yeah.
kind of just like, well, I mean, when you look back at what you were as a teen versus what you are now, it's almost as though it might as well have been a past life.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yes.
So, okay. So how do we deal with not confusing our desire to not pay our karmic tab, so to speak, and the thing that we actually want? How do I discern these two things?
That's fascinating. This question, and I've wrestled with this myself, you know, how does one pay the karmic debt while also pursuing aspiration?
Yeah.
You know, because it seems like these could be two tasks that pull you in opposite directions. And now it's interesting. If you were to speak to somebody who was a traditional Hindu, he or she would say, well, what is karma? Karma can be seen as the accumulation of past lives, and as you were alluding, all the events from these past lives. If you were to speak to somebody who's interested in, say, the multiple worlds theory of the physicist Hugh Everett, and Hugh Everett, who was interpreting the Schrodinger's cat experiment to mean that we live in multiple worlds. There are multiple outcomes and possibilities. There's an infinitude of events going on all the time, all around us, which is why I use the word select rather than manifest, because I groove to what Hugh Everett was talking about. And he would say, well, you know, if you were to take that idea to its ultimate extent, it's possible that there are an infinitude of lives, episodes, things occurring all around us. And Hugh Everett might say, you know, I agree with the traditional Hindu, but he and I have a little bit of a different way of looking at things. I don't so much see it as past lives as I do intimate lives. And what happens in those intimate lives may be going on all the time. Wow. So your way of paying your karmic debt, so to speak, might be selecting something different, might be selecting an approach of nonviolence if there's been violence in your past, at least in as much as you can cognitively recall it. So I always tell people, you know, this act of selection could be not only your pathway into entering an experience, but it also could be a manner of paying the karmic tab, so to speak, and choosing a path or attempting to choose a path of nonviolence to the greatest extent possible can be extremely important. And when I say nonviolence, I'm not just limiting that strictly to a physical definition, but what I'm saying is not doing anything that would violate anybody else's ability to seek his or her highest sense of self-expression.
Right. Man, that is such a great definition. And how easy is it to hear nonviolence and think, okay, no problem. I'm just not going to go around punching people.
Right.
You know, you hear something like that and you're like, ah, that's easy. Nonviolence. Right. I'm not very violent. And then I find myself sitting with someone and I am giving them an unholy ear beating about Kagyu Buddhism.
Yeah.
And I'm
watching
this aggressive recitation of something they're clearly not that interested in.
Right, right.
Pouring out of me that in this weird, it's like feels masturbatory and it's gross to watch. And you want to jump out of your own body because you're like watching this, like, this person, they are nice because they're listening to you.
Yeah.
Yet, if I look at like the energy that I'm, that's sort of tied up in the thing I'm saying, there's aggression.
Aggression. And I will say this, and I don't say this to be morbidly self-disclosing, but I say it because I think people will relate to this. I can track out periods of my life, especially where I'm standing there in front of the shaving mirror and I'm shaving away and my thoughts are just going on this repeat loop. And I'm having these horrible revenge fantasies, things that I might never act on in a tactile way. But I'm thinking of people who said or did something that really pissed me off, people who did something that I felt was really selfish or irresponsible. And I look at the clock and an hour and 15 minutes have passed. And I've been thinking about this person while I'm shaving, while I'm showering, while I'm preparing breakfast, while I'm commuting, while I'm riding my bike, whatever it is. And I ask myself, what am I unleashing in my life? I mean, medically, you could tell, you know, if you sort of hooked me up to various sensory equipment, that there's probably bad stuff going on in my body. But what else is going on? Yeah. What else is going on? And that's a kind of violence. That's a kind of, of violence of the psyche. And I believe it has to have consequence. And that's been one of the most difficult things for me to wrap myself around, you know, because these thoughts can become very revolving and consume enormous amounts of time and energy.
Right.
What's the consequence of that?
Ooh, I know. You know, I had this this realization, this sort of paranoid realization. I was thinking about shit talking, you know, the habit that people have of shit talking.
Heavy. Yes. Yes.
Heavy. And like, you know, so there's a pastime of shit talking, you know, I'm a comedian. So many of my friends are comedians and my God, it's like tennis for comedians, you know, it's like,
yeah.
It was okay. But so I was just sort of thinking though about this sort of game, and it's a, you know, the shit talk game where you'll bring up some person. And then within that, there's usually like the masquerade of a, maybe some kind of legitimate concern.
Yeah.
Is blah, blah, blah okay?
Right, right.
Did you see what you know what I mean?
Right.
But really, within it is like, well, you've sort of, you've taken this like, a simulated version of a person and thrown it out on this weird game board, which is the connection between you and the person talking. It's an arena. And then you start letting these judgment lions run out to attack the person until the person has just been desiccated by both of you and your friend's sophisticated and self-righteous outlook. So I was thinking about that and I was thinking, wait a minute. If there were some metaphysical / mycelial connective mechanism connecting us to that person, then you'd be charging that person up with all your negativity.
Yeah.
And maybe that person, when you got around them, would act in some way that they might not have because they've gotten this heavy charge. Well, anyway, I had this dream after I'd been thinking that and getting really paranoid. And the dream was this, you know, I'm sure you get these dreams. Someone comes and tells you something and you can never, I can never see who it is.
Yeah.
And the person is saying to me, it's usually a group of people these days, but this, people are saying, listen, regardless whether that's true or not, you have created a part of your brain that is this person. Mm-hmm. It's a simulated person. And
yes.
And when you're talking good shit point. About the person, really what you're doing is cutting a little tiny simulated part of your brain.
Yes.
And hurting yourself. You're just, you know, it doesn't matter. The mycelial, who knows?
Yes. Yes.
But why are you like beating up something that's living in your head?
Yes.
That.
You know, speaking in terms of the practical, and you were asking me before about what a person can do who's in anguish or who's in some desperate situation. I want to lay this on everybody and on myself. And this is really the truth. And you can use this, and you can use this right now. If you desist from all gossip and tale-bearing and rumor-spreading, you will find yourself standing more erect almost instantly.
Yeah.
There is a nobility that gets infused in the character of the person who resists gossip and rumors and trash talk that is felt almost immediately. And it's incredible. When I was a kid, I had an Orthodox bar mitzvah. I grew up in a traditional Jewish household, and I went to a synagogue in Queens. I read about this in the Miracle Club, and there was a rabbi who was in charge of the youth congregation. And the youth congregation was like the worst job, because these were rowdy kids who didn't want to be cooped up in some basement of a synagogue on a sunny Saturday afternoon. And we behaved like shit, and we were terrible. And one day, this rabbi, whose name was Larry Ziffer, he lives in Baltimore today. I always give dates and names because I want people to be able to shadow me and follow me on this shit so they know I'm not making anything up. I just spoke to Larry recently. Larry Ziffer, he was a youth rabbi. He lives in Baltimore today. And he was speaking to the congregation of kids one morning. You know, just kids, young adolescents, rowdy. And he said, within Judaism, the only sin that surpasses rumor and talebearing is that of murder.
What?
So only by murdering someone have you done something worse in the eyes of the Creator than if you trash talk them and you put them down. And I tell you, that room full of kids was so silent and so quiet, and you could just feel this pregnant energy in the room where every kid in that room, by dint of his silence, was demonstrating he knew he was being told the absolute truth.
Yeah.
And I swear to you, I'll never forget these words. Larry, who was a slight man, a thin man, he looked out, but it could have been as if a 12-foot giant was talking to us. He said to the group of kids, "There's no joke about it. There's no joke about it. That gossip and talebearing is surpassed only by murder. Because when you're killing someone's reputation, that is tantamount to wiping out the individual." And I never forgot it. I was 9 years old and I never forgot it. And the beauty of this is, and thank you, Larry, is available to everybody. All you need to do is, you're being asked, desist from rumor, desist from gossip. People don't want to do it because it's enjoyable. It floods us with adrenaline. It makes us feel important. We like to interject ourselves into the lives of other people. We're afraid that we're going to be boring to people if we don't gossip and talebear. Yeah. We won't have the goodies to expose to them, you know, at lunch and everything. My challenge is, just try it. You'll feel out of sorts for about an hour. That feeling will pass and you will feel so much better. Yeah. It's a universal law. Just try it.
Wow, man. Yeah. It's almost like conversational alcoholism or something.
Yes, you know, exactly.
Alcoholics feel like they gotta do this
shit. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And you do, I've noticed, like, one thing to do, which I wouldn't, I mean, I listened to Mitch but
playing traffic.
The next thing time you do find yourself doing this game of like shit talking somebody with someone, instead of stopping yourself, maybe give yourself one more time to do it. But this time, actually really look at the way you feel when you're doing it.
Yes.
Because it's like, yeah, I guess there is this kind of like it's eating something that's like hyper, hyper sweet or
perfectly
something.
Perfectly put. That's exactly the analogy I've used myself. It's a sugar high and you crash and you feel awful. Yeah, you feel disoriented. You feel awful.
Awful,
yeah,
man.
I've had that experience. Yeah.
So do it and maybe watch how bad you feel. And then it's like, oh, this is not even a good, this sucks. But then how about this, Mitch? So we have the person who has started to wake up. And because they've stumbled into their place because of either prayers they didn't even know they were saying when they were a kid, or prayers of the action of unconsciousness or whatever, not only are they surrounded by kind of like living situation that they don't really want to be in anymore or ever, but also they find themselves surrounded by people who are reflecting that state of consciousness. So what are they to do when suddenly they realize it's not really enough for me right now to just shift my thinking if it also I'm going to experience a direct rejection from everyone around me because they are all devotees of shit talk land. Yeah. They're devotees of violence. They want to hurt. They like the low vibe. They like to scratch the flesh of life in this way or that way. And I don't want to do that anymore. Yeah. But that being said, I don't want to be a high-roading, self-righteous piece of shit and stick my nose up. And then, you know what I mean? So how is a person to navigate? We need friends. We need our connections. We need our friends. What are you to do? It's very similar, again, to when an alcoholic sobers up.
Yeah. That's a very important question because people are very often surrounded by others by whom they feel intimidated, by whom they feel put down, who they feel are negative towards them. I would say that it is incumbent upon you, absolutely incumbent upon you, to separate yourself from cruel people. Do it immediately. Do it without reservation and burn your bridges behind you.
Wow.
And it's that simple. And there are people who are listening to this who are saying, okay, great, but I can't do that because it's my boss or it's somebody I depend upon economically or whose house I live in. And I recognize that. And I would say, do it silently. The point is not to be high and mighty or not to visit upon somebody your own impressions of them because they have their own impressions of you.
Right.
And the point is to do it silently, separate it first inwardly and vow to yourself and write out the vow if necessary and sign it and carry it with you that you will at the first possible opportunity separate from them physically, however long it takes. And if you want inspiration, I'm going to recommend a very unusual source for this. And I want to be very clear that I'm not drawing any kind of analogy because I'm about to invoke the name of a sacred man. And that sacred man is Frederick Douglass, who wrote 3 memoirs, all of them outstanding stories of human endurance about his life as a slave and his escape from slavery and his emergence as a hero of abolitionism. Frederick Douglass told this story in all 3 of his memoirs, and it can be read and profited from on many different levels in any of his memoirs. He talked about, at the age of 15, standing up to a cruel slave master and getting into a physical confrontation with this man, whose name was Covey, for about 2 hours. And Covey, who was famously known as a breaker of slaves and was a very sadistic, horrible figure, was unable to get the best of Frederick physically. And Frederick felt that Covey was probably somewhat embarrassed by this. And Frederick wrote that at that moment, I experienced an inner revolution that would never really be able to be rolled back, that would never be able to be reversed. I had asserted myself as an independent human being. I had successfully stood up to this man, and I was still enslaved. I was still enslaved. But I vowed to myself inwardly that from that moment, I would be inwardly free, and I would look for and find the first possible opportunity to be physically free, cool. which he did a couple of years later. And I would never, never compare the circumstances of anybody's life in the 21st century to the circumstances faced by a 15-year-old boy who had been forced into slavery. But the psychological verity of what Frederick Douglass was writing there is universally applicable. And I think he wanted it to be universally applicable. He was not able to escape from slavery at that particular point in his life. But it was a turning point. He did assert himself independently. And it doesn't have to be a physical assertion. Yeah. And sometimes it can't be a physical assertion. But pay attention to the part where he vowed inwardly that he would be forever separate from this horrible institution that had enslaved him. And at the first possible opportunity, he would be physically separate. Read Frederick Douglass's memoirs. Any one of them tells this story. Any one of them is equally valid. You can find any one of them online. You can find it on your phone right now. Make that inner vow and separate from cruel people.
I love it, man. It's really interesting to me that that sometimes, though, you do have to make an actual, if you're in an abusive situation,
yes.
you've got to get out.
Yes.
Stop tricking yourself. Also, a lot of times if you're in an abusive situation, you will, your first analysis will be there is no exit. It is a
yes.
prison. But then if you really think about it,
right.
you'll realize like, well, I mean, I do have a small key in my pocket. There's usually some.
It's usually something.
Some
yeah.
way out.
Yeah.
But in, there are other situations that are different from this and not so immediately horrible.
Of course, yeah.
But, what do you have to say about the idea that when you begin to make this a vow, so to speak, or connect with this internal freedom that really doesn't seem to be necessarily based on transitory phenomena?
Yeah.
That there seems to be a natural falling away of the other people in your
that's
life.
That's right. That's right.
What is that similar? Is that actually a kind of representation of this thought metaphysics? In other words, by sort of, you know, you just started meditating and maybe you started eating a little better and maybe
yeah.
you started exercising
yeah.
and you stopped drinking. And then all of a sudden you look around, you realize like, wait, I have a lot of new friends.
Right. Right.
I didn't do anything. I
right.
didn't make some dramatic call.
Right.
I didn't, you know, it just kind of naturally happened. As
right.
though, weirdly, it's like I'm in a completely different universe.
Right.
What is that? Do you really, this concept of, what did you say? Choosing, picking?
Selecting. Yeah, yeah.
Is this as though they're like, there's like a multiverse and we're like throwing some kind of grappling hook into some version of ourself? And very quickly, are we the ones throwing the grappling hook, or is some future version of ourselves throwing lines out and pulling us in?
What a wonderful question. You know, it's a lot to bite off, but I'll try to be very plain about it. I do believe that our minds have extra physical qualities. And if somebody who is materialist was listening to our conversation, they would probably agree with much of what we're saying. Yeah, separate from cruel people. And yeah, you might find yourself in different circumstances, different relationships, because psychologically you've done the right thing, X, Y, and Z. And that's fine. And I believe all that's true. But I'm not a materialist. And I do take an extra physical perspective on existence. And I write about this in some detail in the book, and I'm speaking about it in shorthand now, but I do believe in Hugh Everett's analysis. I do believe there is a superposition, a quality complex to life, and that there's an infinitude of things happening. And when we select something through our emotionalized thoughts or our mental pictures or our perspective, it's almost like we're imposing a matrix grid on this infinitude, and we're locating one thing in time. And you've raised a magnificent question. Who's locating? Is it me, the speaker right now, or is it Mitch in the future who's doing it? I've wondered whether we possess one mind, but it's ever operative. And things that I'm recollecting right now as my past, things that happened 5 minutes ago, things that happened 30 years ago that are as real to me as the chair that I'm seated upon right now, might be things that are ever changing, ever operative, ever morphing, ever transitioning, based on the perspective that I have concentrated on or selected or chosen. in the, I can't say right now, but I can say in the experience that I'm having, an experience that has in itself a past, a present, a future, all of which feels as real to me, apropos of the past, as the words that I'm uttering to you right now, but which might be ever-changing. There may be one mind that I experience as linear, because that's what my sensory equipment permits, but in fact, I'm selecting from among an infinitude of things, which I'm just experiencing as in the present right now, because that's my capacity.
Yeah, it's like, it's almost as though, like, let's, you know, you've got all these little creeks, and the creeks turn into rivers, and the rivers join together, and now you have this one river, and that river turns into the ocean.
Right.
And maybe those little creeks, they're like, have you, you know, I've heard.
Yeah.
I've heard of a place where we're really fucking big.
Right.
You know, and this, shut up, you fucking hippie. I don't know what you're talking about, right? And maybe the little creeks might say to the other, you know, we're going to become the same thing eventually. Or, you know, we're being pulled. Do you know we're being drawn in? Do you feel this pulling?
Yes.
That's our desire. And who knows? But sometimes I do get this sense, not only of there being this, like, perfected self, or a self that is awakened, that is in some way or another, God, it sounds so absolutely insane, but giving me thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, people might be listening and saying to themselves, well, that's great, but how do I verify any of this?
Yes.
You fucking hippie lunatics, you know? And I would say this, and this is one of the things I write about at the end of the Miracle Club. There's something I think all of us experience and have experienced, which I happen to call a time collapse, where we have these moments of exquisite awareness in life. Sometimes they come at the height of joy and ecstasy. Sometimes they come when we're experiencing this absolute grief that seems to still everything in our lives, that seems to still all the sensory information that's coming to us. They usually come at some kind of extreme event or heightened awareness. We experience time collapses, where we're having an experience not only of deja vu, but of past, present, future, where everything suddenly seems mixed together and everything seems to be occurring at once. And I write about three of these episodes in my own life at the end of the Miracle Club. There are others I could have referenced, but I invite the reader in that case to think of times, as I'm sure most will, where he or she has had such experiences, where everything seems to be occurring at once. And it feels extraordinarily real. And you could say, well, that's just an experience. And it's like, well, sure, it's an experience, it's testimony, but what else do we have? I mean, everything that we know about SSRIs, for example, as a class of drugs, comes from experience, comes from testimony. Everything that we know about pain management comes from experience, comes from testimony. It's a tool. It's a tool. So I'd say this can be a kind of metaphysical tool, if I can put it in those terms. Watch for or think back on those periods of time collapse where everything seemed to be happening at once. Everything seemed to be functioning with a kind of congruity.
Yes.
That may be reality. That may be a wonderful measurement.
That's great. Wow. You know what? We are now, I know you have a busy schedule. So, man, as much as I would love to kidnap you for probably at least a week to chat with you, unfortunately, you have to go. You're doing a talk. Where is it? The Manly P. Hall?
4 o'clock at Manly P. Hall School, the Philosophical Research Society.
Unfortunately, this will have already gone up, or this won't have gone up.
But if everything's happening at once, you can still avail yourself of it, right? So, good cheer.
I'm very grateful to you for this time.
Thank you.
And how can people find you?
If you throw my name into Google, Mitch Horowitz, it'll take you to my website. My email is there. You can write to me. I answer everybody who writes to me. You can find me on Twitter at Mitch Horowitz, on social media. I've been writing lately at medium.com. I'm a contributor there.
Cool.
A lot of what we've been talking about, I explore there. And the new book is called The Miracle Club.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
I hope to talk to you again soon.
Likewise.
That was the wonderful Mitch Horowitz, everybody. All the links you need to get to Mitch will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Much thanks to our sponsors, BlueChew.com. Use promo code Duncan to get some free magical boner pills. And also, if you go to squarespace.com/Duncan and use offer code Duncan, you'll get 10% off your first website or a domain. If you like us, subscribe, give us a good rating, give yourself a good rating. I'll see y'all real soon. Got some great episodes coming up. Until then, Hare Krishna.